Well, Sepphoris is one of the major Roman period settlements in the Galilee. It's located about 3 miles north-northwest of Nazareth, and I think you all know what Nazareth is. And much of its fascination derives from the fact that Jesus, of course, was raised in Nazareth, and Sepphoris, during his lifetime, becomes the capital of the Galilee, the administrative capital of the northern portion of Israel.
Religion scholar Eric Myers with arts educator Rebecca Martin Nagy. He's here to talk about Sepphoris in Galilee, an archaeological exhibit representing cross currents of culture. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Following the discussion about Sepphoris, a conversation this week about the law in ancient Rome. You'll hear from Yale University historian John Matthews. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products.
The most exciting finds have been the mosaics. The first really beautiful and important mosaic discovered at Sepphoris was one dealing with the god Dionysos, the god of wine and revelry, which was discovered in 1987. Mm-hmm. That brought Sepphoris to the attention of the world, really, for its art, for this wonderful mosaic. But since then, in the last few years, more and more fabulous mosaics continue to be uncovered.
Rebecca Martin Nagy of the North Carolina Museum of Art. She worked with Eric Myers of Duke University and with authorities in Israel and North Carolina, including Governor Jim Hunt and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to produce Sepphoris in Galilee. This exhibition, currently on display at the North Carolina Museum of Art, springs from an archaeological site that was one of the most important cities in Roman Palestine. The great Jewish historian Josephus Flavius called Sepphoris the ornament of all Galilee. It was a thriving provincial capital where Jews, pagans, and later Christians coexisted. Among the remarkable discoveries at Sepphoris was a mosaic that's come to be known as the Mona Lisa of Galilee.
Well, this is, in a way, how the whole story of the exhibition begins, because when the archaeologists from Duke University, with whom Eric works, and from Hebrew University, they were working together at that time, in 1987 discovered this magnificent mosaic with the Dionysiac scenes. It was published around the world in the media. And one of the most striking images was that of a beautiful woman who actually appears in the border of the mosaic. She's not a central motif, really, but she becomes central because she's very well preserved and also so beautifully executed. So this grabbed my attention, as it did so many other people's, and I invited Eric and Carol Myers from Duke University to come over to the North Carolina Museum of Art to present a lecture on their work at Sepphoris. After their lecture, we started talking about ideas for an exhibition. This was back in 1987, so it's taken a long time to come to fruition, but the Mona Lisa of Galilee, as the woman is called because of her mysterious beauty, could get some credit for starting the whole idea, I think.
Mm-hmm. Eric?
Well, I think it's important also to speak about the context of this wonderful mosaic. It's a magnificent Roman period mansion that dates to the 3rd century CE. It's contemporary with the major Jewish figure at the site at the time, Rabbi Judah the Patriarch, who is best known for his compilation of the Mishnah, around 200. So when we have a image of the rabbis that we conjure in our heads, bookish, studious types, we now have to modify that to think of them living in a very, very beautiful setting in which there was theater, in which there was a meeting place with these gorgeous mosaics on the floor.
Mm-hmm. What about the written records? Is there a sense of the way the people themselves, this heterogeneous mixture of peoples and religions and cultures that came together in Sepphoris, how did they think about the city? Was it special to them? Did they have any sense of of what they were doing and the kind of record that they were creating that you two have reproduced here in modernity?
This is very problematic because the major repository of reflections of the Jewish community is the Mishnah. And this is a highly edited, highly sifted document. It's very unfair to women, I would say. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take daily life seriously in the way that this exhibition is taking. So we have to get through that data very, very painfully. And the same thing is true for some of the casual remarks in the early Christian literature. So we're not able to reconstruct life from those kinds of literature. On the other hand, we have material from inscriptions, from tomb inscriptions, from ostraca-inscribed shards, and from the first century historian Josephus that gives us a better sense of what the city was like. Together with the material cultural remains and this variety of written remains, we're able to get a good sense of the city.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean that what we see in Sepphoris is, the way to put the question is this, was it an altogether alien culture? Would it make sense to a man or a woman of the 20th century to be sort of parachuted into these circumstances?
Well, I think most modern individuals would have a problem living in the kind of stone houses that we find throughout antiquity and right up until the modern period. The modern residents of Sepphoris in the 18th or 19th century also lived in stone houses. They burnt wood to heat the houses. They took baths in cold water for the most part, mm-hmm. and they lit the houses without electricity. And I don't know about you, but bathing in cold water in when it's 30 degrees outside, and it's very cold in the lower Galilee in the mountains there in winter, and most of the year it's very unpleasant to be in the dank, dark atmosphere of these stone houses. You have to get a real sense of the lifestyle to appreciate the difficulties and hardships of daily life.
Well, is it fair to say that the art that existed in Sepphoris was some sort of a consolation? That this was, today we take comfort, so to speak, in the art that we create and inhabit. Is the same thing true back then, Rebecca?
Well, I think so. I was thinking about that earlier, driving over. Some of the beautiful art that we see, the mosaics, for instance, or the frescoes that adorned the walls of mansions, may have been reserved for the very well-to-do. Uh-huh. And we can't be sure that the average citizens of Sepphoris had the opportunity to enjoy that. On the other hand, when the synagogues were beautifully decorated with mosaics, all of the worshipers could enjoy and benefit from that art later in the churches, similarly, or the theater, which was a very elaborate structure, very beautifully decorated. Apparently, everyone went to the theater or had that opportunity. So certainly there were cultural and artistic activities that could enhance everyone's life.
Mm-hmm. Let me present you with an enormous issue. Eric Myers and Rebecca Martin-Nagy were talking about the Sepphoris exhibit that came from ancient Palestine, the modern state of Israel, to North Carolina. Is there anything to be learned from Sepphoris that in any way answers some of our current political tensions today? Does this exist solely in the art museums? Is it part of what I suppose a cynic might call real life? Eric?
I would like to think that the city of Sepphoris, with its diverse population, its diverse ethnic makeup, Jews, Christians, Romans, and others, other sectarians living together, somehow provides a model for all of us to emulate. They apparently lived and worshipped on their own terms. They lived in harmony, church along a synagogue on a main thoroughfare, and shared common resources, common fields, common water sources. All of these things are kind of an inspiration, and it's counter to the to the trend in the Middle East today. The Christians live in the Christian quarter, the Muslims live in the Muslim quarter, so to speak, and the Jews do their own thing. And in the ancient city, at least in the Mediterranean world, in the Middle East in particular, these communities had a much closer living arrangement among the diverse populations there.
Here we have this little postage stamp of politics and culture, artistic expression. I want you to be very concrete for our listeners. Name an aspect of this exhibit that it might be your favorite, that has stayed with you, that's important to you. My sense is that most of our listeners aren't actually going to have the opportunity to see Sepphoris. But let's use our imaginations here. What comes to mind, Eric?
As spectacular as the photo murals will be and the pieces of mosaic that will be represented there, I think the everyday artifacts, pottery, small objects, toggle pins, you name it, little eating vessels, and then we'll show the food that was consumed in them, and we'll show some of the meat, the bones left from the meat that was eaten and so on. For me, that's the essence of the exhibition, and to see it juxtaposed with some of the great monuments enable you to see how life was lived alongside these great buildings and these great artistic pieces.
Fair enough. Rebecca, I'll give you the last word.
Well, what I'm really taking away from the exhibition, and I think this will be reflected for visitors or possibly someone who may see the exhibition catalog and not be able to visit the exhibition, is echoing all of the different cultures and peoples who live together at Sepphoris, all of the people and all of the institutions who had to come together to rediscover this place. We've worked with archaeologists from a number of different universities, with scholars from many different museums and institutions, and it's this cooperation, this working together. It's not always easy. It can be very challenging, but the results are so rewarding, and this project really could not have happened without probably hundreds of people working together on it to bring it to reality.
Rebecca Martin-Nagy is Associate Director of Education at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Eric Myers is a professor of religion at Duke University. Working with authorities in Israel and North Carolina, they helped to prepare Sepphoris in Galilee, an archaeological exhibit currently on display at the North Carolina Museum of Art. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, more ancient mosaics. Yale University historian John Matthews is here to talk about the law in ancient Rome.
The Romans had an immensely involved system of law, which they developed over centuries. They left it to modern Europe, in many parts of modern Europe, in France, and, of course, Dutch law, South African law in other parts of the world. In many parts of the world, Roman law is a living influence on the law as it is lived now. In some parts of the world, that is not the case. But the Romans did have the tremendous ability to think about what they were doing and to explain it. And even though what they did were different from what we do, we can understand their talk about it.
Historian John Matthews. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a new study about the law in ancient Rome. His forthcoming book is entitled Laying Down the Law, An Introduction to the Theodosian Code. John Matthews is a professor in the Department of Classics and History at Yale University. John, you spend your professional life between the 3rd and the 6th centuries A.D. in ancient Rome. Is it possible to generalize for our listeners and talk to people here in the 1990s about what life was like in the ancient world? I mean, are they just two utterly different kinds of propositions when we look at the way we live, think about life back then?
Could I answer you as an Englishman? Have you ever seen a game of cricket? It's a game of marvelous beauty and of immense complication.
Right.
And what I want to say is that if you get a person who doesn't know the game, like an American professor of metallurgy, for example, and show them it being played, they haven't the faintest idea what's going on. It's impossible to see what's happening by observing the game. It's equally hard if you want to try to explain the rules of cricket. That's very, very hard to do. The best way is to take individual episodes one by one and try to get them to fit together. Mm-hmm. But that takes a long time. Now, what you've done is throw the book of rules at me. And I think writing history is at least as complicated as understanding cricket.
we are the same species, after all.
Well, put it otherwise, there's a novel by L.P. Hartley, The Go-Between.
Uh-huh. Right.
And the first sentence of that is, the past is another country. Uh-huh. They do things differently there.
Right.
But he goes on to write about it. And I think the relationship between the past and the present is one that doesn't always come easily, but it can be got if one works at it.
Mm-hmm.
The Roman Empire, I think, is no more remote than other things that one studies quite cheerfully. After all, people spend countless millions studying the origins of the entire universe. But right. I don't see that as a more relevant question than the origins of our system of law, do you?
Fair enough. Well, let's talk about law. That's what you have been here at the Humanities Center writing about. Would there be something analogous in ancient Roman society to what we call the Supreme Court?
The source of law in the Roman Empire was the Roman Emperor. Almost from the start, and he was the chief source of law and the source of appeal from which one had no further appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's no institutional framework like the Supreme Court, but there is an individual, but the emperors in resolving matters of law like this didn't do it arbitrarily, they did it through jurists.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, did the emperor arbitrate or negotiate or fix the law at what we would call the highest levels or the lowest levels? I mean, did the emperor get involved with parking tickets, or was it all, very noble, high-flown, conceptual kinds of stuff?
It's an interesting question, that. In a sense, the emperor might do anything. There's nothing one doesn't sometimes find the emperor doing.
Uh-huh.
Occasionally, you do find him dealing with what we would, compare to parking tickets. There's one inscription which I'm thinking of, which is from a fishing community on the Lower Danube. Hmm. And they sent a deputation to the emperor to defend the fishing rights, which were being attacked by somebody else. And he heard the case and resolved it, gave a reply. They took the reply back and they then put it up on an inscription in their hometown, which is how we know about the whole situation.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's hundreds of examples of the emperors doing really quite absurdly detailed things like that.
Right.
On the other hand, it would be ridiculous to imagine the emperor spent all their time in that way.
Uh-huh.
There was a hierarchy of officials and there was a system of screening out the trivial inquiries, for example, like that one. But some did get through at all times.
One of the popular conceptions is that ancient Rome was a cruel society and a violent society. I mean, I'm thinking of, the circuses and all those Christians dying in the Colosseum with the lions. Is this a bum rap that Rome takes? And what does it have to do with the law that you're studying?
It's a very complicated question, that, and I don't know the answer. I don't know the psychology of the answer, that's to say. The Romans did have this capacity for extraordinary depths and levels of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And the curious thing is not only that they tolerated these things, but they actually, in a sense, admired them. There's a mosaic found in a villa on what would be the modern Libyan coast. And it's on the floor of, I suppose, the dining room.
Right.
It has a border around the edge which shows scenes from the gladiatorial show of the amphitheatre, including scenes of individuals being exposed to wild beasts. And one would think that was a disagreeable thing to have on the dining room floor, at least.
Absolutely.
But the Romans lived with that as part of their mm-hmm. ideology. I think one needs to be awfully careful about one's own mentality in talking about this. There were certainly laws against violence of all sorts.
Right.
There were laws against domestic and public and political violence. The law, though, was enforced by violence. And that is maybe a central feature of the Roman legal system.
Well, the larger contradiction then, John, would be here we have a group of social critics in the 1990s, particularly in North America, looking back to the Romans and saying, they are our models. That's the one of the fundamentals of our inheritance. And when we speak of law and literature and history, are we suffering from selective amnesia or selectivity in our memory as we look back and look at the Romans as a model and conveniently forgetting all of this violence that you're describing?
I don't know if it's amnesia. It's important to look back at any historical model critically, however you may admire it.
Uh-huh.
It'd be crazy to say that there's nothing in Roman culture which is admirable. They had a system of law which is unmatched, really, certainly to that date, and in most parts of the world, today. It's simply the majority of the world has nothing like.
Well, what makes it memorable? Let's pause on this for a moment. The fact that it was written down, for example?
It was written down, therefore it could be appealed to.
Uh-huh.
You had a claim on it being consistent. It was argued. It was theorized about, rationalized. The Romans knew what they were doing. They achieved, within their own social parameters,
mm-hmm.
they achieved fairness between individuals and consistency in the law itself.
Now, when you say fairness between individuals, again, let's open a little pocket of parentheses here, John Matthews. How did the Romans treat their women and their children? One of the watchwords from the liberal side of the social critical spectrum is that the way you treat the least among you gives you a real good insight into the way a society runs itself. How about that?
Women, perhaps surprisingly, had far greater rights at Roman law than in most modern societies until recently. For example, they had rights of ownership of property.
Mm-hmm.
They could administer property. They could litigate about property. There were certain conventions which were more or less formal as time went on, whereby they had to have an agent acting for them in a court of law. But there's a whole dossier of replies given by emperors in the late 3rd century. These are private rulings given by emperors and their jurists to individual petitioners. 25% of these petitioners were women.
Oh.
Now, that's is inconceivable, say, in 19th century Britain.
Right.
Women's rights in the Roman Empire far exceeded anything available in Britain since 1870.
So women and children, to come back to that question I asked you, were not necessarily looked upon as a minority. I mean, is that a modern kind of legal conception to think of the minorities among us?
Women weren't a minority, and nobody, I think, in Rome thought of them as that. There were things they didn't do. They weren't active directly in politics. They didn't hold power or political office. Their role was seen as being in the household rather than in politics. This wasn't seen, I think, to make them... Well, there was a view, I suppose, that women's judgment could be unreliable and flimsy. You sometimes get jurists saying this in discussing, I'm afraid to say, the application of judicial torture, that women and children under 14 were liable to be scared and not to be very firm facing torture.
Let me stop you, John. Does this translate into a modern term like sexism? Is that too crude? Is that unfair to the Romans to call them sexist, therefore?
I think it's too crude. I think that seems to me to be rather a too general definition of sexism to be very useful. But what I don't find in the Roman Empire are specific prejudices against women for being women.
John, let's talk about religion and the law in ancient Rome. Here we live in what purports to be essentially a monotheistic society. Rome, to grandly generalize here, believed in a whole pantheon of gods. Now, you have told us, John Matthews, that the law basically focused in the person of the Roman emperor. Did he look to the gods and say, well, that's where I'm getting the law?
No. The emperors thought of the gods as their general protectors. It was important not to upset the gods. It wasn't that the gods gave you great prosperity or success,
right,
except insofar as if you neglected them, you would lose it. So the emperors did claim to be pious and therefore fortunate, and they did perform sacrifice religiously, as we would say, dutifully.
Right.
But they didn't expect from that to get particular benefits from the gods. The danger was in ignoring the gods. If you ignored the gods, you disturbed their peace of mind, as it were. They might turn against you. They would unleash hurricane, pestilence, earthquake, the crops would fail, the weather would be awful, and so on. But that was more a consequence of neglecting the gods. You didn't pray to the gods for the normal well-being.
Well, now, that kind of an example, John Matthews, sounds utterly foreign to the legal sensibility, the popular imagination of the law here in North America in the 1990s. And I take it that that is obviously not a dimension of Roman law that comes to us in the modern world. What are the dimensions of Roman law that are still in force, that influence the way we do law in the modern world?
I think they're very basic assumptions, that there is a rule of law. There are general principles of life which are defended by law, and the application of these principles is consistent, and that it takes account of precedent so that the law can evolve and develop as the needs of the society evolve and develop. So the emperor's laws were the documentary basis. There were then the jurists who analysed and studied this and criticised it and produced from it law, the law, which was the statement of general principles. And the emperor made the laws, the jurists inferred the law.
Suppose the two disagreed. Who had the final word?
The judge sitting in a case always had the final word, except, of course, that a litigant or accused criminal might appeal against his jurisdiction on stated grounds, and the appeal, if permitted, would go to a higher court. As in any court of law, I think, disputes are settled by the judge subject to appeal. Romans had a very complicated and elaborate system of appeals, but if it went to the emperor, that was the end. There's no one to appeal to after that.
John Matthews teaches in the Department of Classics and History at Yale University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a study of the law in ancient Rome. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were Rebecca Martin-Nagy of the North Carolina Museum of Art, Eric Myers of Duke University, and John Matthews of Yale University. For an audio tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 850. Visit our site on the World Wide Web at nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week, in partnership with the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, Soundings will present another segment in our continuing series on the history and social implications of information technology. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.